If you don't have a Bible, it's probably worth grabbing one. There's a bookcase, a couple of bookcases at the back that you can get one. And this week we're going to be taking a break from Luke that we've been working through, and we're going to be looking at one of the church vision statements. If you look in the back of the notice sheets, if you've got one, we've kind of put some of these bullet points down as to what we see as a vision for Hillview Community Church, and really try and capture some of what it is we believe God has called us to be as a church here in Hillview. We don't want these just to be ignored and neglected, which is why we're kind of preaching through these as you'll see them interspersed through the year. But we also recognize that they're not the final word, and they only become a reality as we prayerfully seek God to help us more adequately display His glory by engaging with those. So this morning I want to be looking at we see a church that is honest and relevant is where we're going to go this morning. Maybe it's because I'm an engineer, maybe it's just because I'm a bit weird, but I like to count things. I just can't seem to help myself. The number of tiles on the wall or the floor, I'm constantly flicking through the onboard computer in the car to figure out what the stats are, and I've even got an app on my iPhone to clock every mile I do on my bike and stuff like that. It's just a bit nuts. So when I was kind of thinking about relevant and honest, I thought, well, what does the Bible say about honesty and what does it say about relevance? And so I used my Bible app with my ESV version online and did a search, which you can do these days. And in the ESV, honest or honesty appears 28 times. And in the NIV, it appears a total of 14 times. What's interesting, though, is when you look for relevant or relevance, it doesn't appear a single time. So there's something like 775,000 words in the ESV as well, just for those that want to know that. The Harry Potter series has just over a million words, so maybe just think about how difficult it is to read our Bibles, perhaps, as well. That's not a challenge, by the way, for you to look for any other word that doesn't appear in the ESV while I'm preaching this morning, but I was kind of thinking that. I was sort of struck by that. Well, so why would the Bible not talk about relevance or relevant as a word? And then it dawned on me, I guess, during the week. And I think fundamentally, God doesn't have to prove to us that He's relevant. God is absolutely, supremely, and wholly absolute. He is the great I Am. He revealed Himself to Moses as I am who I am. He's the ultimate reality by which everything else should be defined and related to. He's a triune God. He just is. He's the Father who loves and gives life to the Son through the fellowship of the Spirit. So the Bible presumes that God is relevant. After all, He was here before anybody else. It's His universe to do whatever He wants with. And I think one of the big problems that we have as a world and as a people, if we're honest enough with ourselves, is we've actually tried to flip that reality on its head. The question that people ask today, is God relevant or is the Bible relevant? That's not what we should be asking. And, we're immersed in a culture that's post-Christian, secularized, and what do we have to say as a church into that culture now about the relevance of God? Timmy, do you want to put the PowerPoint slide up? So one of the things that you'll see on the church website and also in the things in the replant proposal document that we had as a church is there's a bit of subtext really below what we mean by seeing a church that is honest and relevant. We'll be authentic. We'll acknowledge the joys and pains of life. We'll seek God's presence and purposes in those. We won't sugarcoat the reality of sin in the world or in our lives. We'll confront hard issues, acknowledging that though we don't know all the answers, we believe that God is in control. As I was reflecting on those words, preparing for this, and some of the theme that's already come out this morning, if you've been been tuned in, is that a lot of life is hard. A lot of life is about trials and struggles. So what's the point of us as a church having a vision statement about being honest and relevant? What are we trying to get after with that? What are we trying to answer that? So this morning, God led me to the book of Joel, which we're going to look at this morning. And Joel is speaking into a nation that's on its knees. It's facing, you know, a famine and a drought that we'll see in Joel chapter 1. But Joel had the courage to speak up and speak into that situation to point out that in actual fact, God is still in control of those circumstances and he still has a plan and a purpose in those circumstances. So what I want to look at this morning is really, what does it mean to be honest before God and what are the consequences of that? I'm really going to focus on Joel chapter 2 this morning, but before I do that, it's probably worth just sort of outlining some of the severity of Joel chapter 1. You'll find, if you've got a pew Bible, you'll find Joel on page 760, and we'll be looking at chapter 2 in just a minute. But one of the things that you find when you read the narrative in Joel is that the prophet describes this complete devastation. There's been a plague of locusts that's completely wiped out all of the crops, and there's a drought and over and above that. And so Joel, with a lot of sort of imagery and language, describes the devastation of these locusts and what they've done in graphic detail for us. In Joel chapter 1, verse 10, it says that the fields are destroyed, the ground mourns because the grain is destroyed, the wine dries up, and the oil languishes. And further down in verse 18, you can see the effects even on the animals. It says, how the beasts groan. The herds of cattle are perplexed because there is no pasture for them. Even the flocks of sheep suffer. I was trying to picture what a perplexed cow looked like when I looked at those words. But, you know, one minute there's grass there, and the next, where's it gone, kind of thing. So, you know, this picture that he paints is of this complete desolation of, you know, in those times, farming was the substance of life. If you didn't have, you know, it's not like today where we can always rely typically on going down to Tesco or Sainsbury's and finding stuff. In these times, these animals, the grain and the oil, are essentials to the material well-being of these people and the life of these people. So chapter 1 really sets the scene. We've got a nation that's starving to death, and there's no rain or hope, it seems. I think there's another interesting point that's raised in Joel chapter 1, where it talks about there isn't even enough grain or oil to make the offerings in the temple. So not only is the people's life cut off, but also it seems that any hope of connecting to their God seems to be cut off as well. And that's the context at which Joel is speaking into. So just having set that scene, really, I want to move on and ask a few questions about what does it look like to be honest before God. And as I said, we're going to do that from Joel chapter 2. There's three things that we wanted to look at. Firstly, I want to look at recognizing that God is actually in control of these circumstances, no matter how bad they are. Then want to consider, well, what does it mean? What are God's purposes and trials in life, not just for the people here, but also for us? Why does God allow us to go through these trials, even if they are of our own making sometimes? And then really want to think about, how should we respond to those trials? What's the response that God is looking for from us in those trials and dealing honestly with that sort of situation? So firstly, just recognizing that God is in control over all of our circumstances and remembering where we are with, you know, the people that are starving. Joel's already made an appeal in chapter 1 for people to wake up and think about the situation that they're in and think about their relationship with God again and that. But it seems that there's no sort of sign of repentance in that. So then Joel 2, seeing all this imagery of locusts wiping things out, Joel starts to describe something that seems to be even more terrifying and even more terrible for the people. So we're going to read Joel chapter 2. I'm just going to read the first 11 verses initially. So if you want to follow along, it says, "Blow a trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm on my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. It is near. A day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Like blackness there is spread upon the mountains a great and powerful people. Their like has never been seen before, nor will be again after them. Through the years of all generations, fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but behind them a desolate wilderness, and nothing escapes them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like war horses they run. As with the rumbling of chariots, they leap on top of the mountains, like the crackling of flame of fire devouring the stubble, like a powerful army drawn up for battle. Before them, people are in anguish. All faces grow pale. Like warriors, they charge. Like soldiers, they scale the wall. They march each on his way. They do not swerve from their paths. They do not jostle one another. Each marches in his path. They burst through the weapons and aren't halted. They leap upon the city. They run upon the walls. They climb up into the houses. They enter through the windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them. The heavens tremble. The sun and moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. The Lord utters his voice before his army, for his camp is exceedingly great. He who executes his word is powerful, for the day of the Lord is great and very awesome." So Joel chapter 2 starts with a wake-up call. Joel is screaming at the people, wake up, pay attention. Why? Because the day of the Lord is coming, a day of clouds and thick darkness. We need to ask ourselves, what does the day of the Lord mean? And there's three perspectives that we need to bear in mind when we read a prophecy like Joel. He's obviously speaking directly into the situation at the time, so there's a current plight that the people are facing. He's also talking about what's coming soon, but ultimately Joel and a lot of the prophecies in the New and the Old Testament look forward to a final day, a day of the Lord when everyone will be called to give an account of their lives before God in heaven. And at that moment, everyone will have to stand before God, and where we end up will be based on how we've responded to God. So what Joel's describing here for us is the coming of God's judgment. And Joel uses this locust imagery really to try and picture this like an army that's arrayed for battle, that's ready to come and invade the land. And it's really to emphasize the peril that the people are in, because he sees that there's something wrong with the people's attitude, and there's something wrong, which means that God has to intervene. I don't know if you've seen the Lord of the Rings sort of movies, but this sort of imagery that you see in chapter 2 that I've just read reminds me of some of the battle scenes, in particular the very final battle scene in the final Lord of the Rings, where there's this small group of people arrayed against a huge army that just covers a complete plain, and it's seemingly unstoppable and completely overwhelming. Some of the imagery that we see in Joel, it says, like blackness there is spread upon the mountains, a great army. Fire devours before them, nothing escapes them. They leap on top of the mountains, like warriors they charge. They march each in his own way, they don't swerve from their paths. So there's complete order and regimentation in this. They seem completely invincible. And just looking at this army makes the people anguish, you know, and groan at the thought of what's about to be unleashed. They grow pale. You know, it's like that sinking sensation when we're faced with something that we know is going to be really unpleasant. We're confronted with things, we just want to crawl away and hide. But what's interesting is that Joel reveals that despite the power, despite the purpose that's in plan for this army, that it's actually God who is in control of it. So even though these circumstances that the people feel that they're faced with that are seemingly completely overwhelming, essentially the prophet is saying to them, "The Lord, this is the Lord's army." And that must have been a pretty shocking thing to hear. It's probably a pretty dangerous business being a prophet, I think. And it doesn't usually make for a long career with a nice pension to look forward to. Through these disasters and through the prophet, God is essentially shouting, wake up, I'm in control. Look at yourself and ask what's happening. What's the problem here? So we've got to ask the question, why does God bring about these circumstances? C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Problem of Pain, describes human pain as God's microphone or megaphone. For anyone that doesn't know what a megaphone is, particularly under the 40s, it's like a microphone connected to a Marshall amp, basically. Okay, it's something that screams at you, that's loud. So when things are going smoothly, we all know that our hearts tend not to incline towards God. But actually, when pain strikes, when we find ourselves up against the real universe, as C.S. Lewis describes it, we realize that everything isn't as it should be. And Lewis describes it as pain removes the veil and plants the flag of truth within the fortress of rebel souls. He gets right to the heart of the issue. The reason that we're in such a mess is ultimately because of the sinfulness of our hearts. And pain is a way that God uses to wake us up to the reality of our peril and the situation that we're in and our need for Him. So pain, the pain that Joel is describing, the pain that they're considering, that the trials that we're faced with in life, albeit, as I say, they may not be direct or particular, direct punishment for particular sins, because the Bible is very clear that even as a Christian, we will face trials in life. There's a verse in Hebrews that talks about even Jesus learning obedience through suffering. That's mind-blowing. This is the Son of God who's completely perfect. He learned obedience through suffering. So God brings these trials, and we've got to ask ourselves, what's the reason for those trials, even if they are things that we don't fully understand? So in verse 12 and 13, if you look at Joel 12 and 13, we see the reason that God has in bringing about these circumstances. It says that, yet even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all of your heart. Notice it is God that takes the initiative. God says that despite what you're experiencing, it's not too late. You need to come back to me. The right place for you to be is in the lap of your Father. The right place to be is with me. God is patient and He wants us to return with all our hearts. And sometimes, to get our attention, He has to bring about circumstances that force us to fall back on Him, because there's things in life that we just can't handle ourselves. They're just too big, and He knows that. So why is it that God brings these circumstances? The thing to note, I think, is in the second half of that phrase, it says that even now, return to me with all your heart. So there seems to be a problem with the people's heart. There's a problem here. The prophet doesn't name specific sins that the people need to be repented from. Rather, there's a deeper problem, it seems to me, that he's pointing to. And it's a problem that their hearts aren't fully directed towards God. Other things seem to have crept in to take his rightful place at the center of their love and desire. If you look back in chapter 5, in chapter 1, verse 5, for example, it says, awake, you drunkards, and weep and wail, all you drinkers of wine, because of the sweet wine, for it's cut off your mouth. It seems to be that, the people have become complacent. They're trying to find comfort in other things other than God. They're trying to find satisfaction in alcohol and completely ignoring who God is and what He's done for them. And, as I talked about at the beginning, we need to define everything in relation to our relationship with God. He is ultimate. And Deuteronomy 10, verse 12, and other places in the Bible, the purpose that He has for mankind is clear. In Deuteronomy 10, verse 12, it says, what does the Lord your God require of you, but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all His ways, to love him, to serve the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul. And in Mark 12:30, Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. God wants nothing short of our hearts and all of our hearts. That's why he made us. He made us to know him, to love him with all our hearts, and to walk with him. And anything short of that just isn't enough. So we see in verse 12 that God takes the initiative and makes it clear what his purpose is. He's saying to the people, return to me with all your hearts. There's a similar warning to this in Revelation. In Revelation chapter 3, in the letters to the churches, Jesus says to the church in Laodicea, quite a chilling and stark thing. He says these words, I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot. Would that you were either cold or hot. So because you're lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. God detests complacency. And sometimes he needs to take drastic measures to get our attention. And those circumstances take away any room for self-reliance. There's no food or water for these people. On top of that, the people are about to be overrun by an even greater devastating force. And he does this to get their attention, to make them wake up and see that the most important thing that they need to do is to get back in relationship, the right relationship with their Father. You know, and as Christians too, we need to guard our hearts against complacency. Every day we need to surrender to God. Every day we need to come back to him time and time again and ask him to make him the desire of our hearts. We've got to get our priorities right. You know, something to think about when you look at your life, when you think about the priorities that you have in your life, what do they actually say about your relationship with God? What do they say about where God sits in that relationship? You know, if you think about your family, your job, your finances, your career, relationships, your home life, the home you live in, the food you eat, your health, your sporting interests, use of your spare time, time spent on email, your Facebook, your Twitter accounts, to what end do all of those pursuits give evidence that God is the single most important priority in your life? So as I said, the point of the circumstances that Joel describes and the people find themselves in is to make the people realize that they actually need God and they need to love him with all of their hearts. And God wants to takes the initiative to restore that relationship in his grace and his mercy. So now we've seen that, what I want to move on to think about is, okay, so we've seen that God is ultimately in control of the circumstances. We see that his purpose in those trials and circumstances is to take away reliance on self and force us back to rely on him. So what does it look like to come before God and actually to respond to him and come back to him with our whole hearts? And I think in verses 12 to 17 that we'll read in just a minute, the key thing that God is looking for is a broken heart. God wants a people who love and serve him, who have a heart like he has. He wants them to have a broken heart. And there's two aspects of the response to look for in Joel 2, verses 12 to 17, which I'm just going to read now. It says in verse 12, so yet even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster. Who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him, a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God. Blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, consecrate the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, even nursing infants. Let the bridegroom leave his chamber and the bride her chamber. Between the vestibule and the altar, let the priests, the ministers of the Lord weep and say, spare your people, O Lord, and make not your heritage or reproach a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God?